worldwide news update. Israel said on Thursday that its ceasefire with Hezbollah was breached hours after Lebanese security sources said Israeli tanks attacked six areas of southern Lebanon, calling into question a truce reached after more than a year of fighting. Israeli military said the ceasefire was violated after what it called suspects, some vehicles, arrived at several areas in the southern zone. One security source said two people were wounded. Under the ceasefire terms, Israeli forces can take up to 60 days to withdraw from southern Lebanon, but neither side can launch offensive operations. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had instructed the military not to allow residents back into villages near the border. Lebanese Speaker of Parliament Nabi Berri had said on Wednesday that residents could return. Russia has conducted what officials call a massive missile and drone attack against Ukraine's energy infrastructure. VOA's Tommy McNeil reports.
Ukraine's energy minister says attacks on energy facilities were happening all across the country Thursday. He says emergency power outages have been implemented nationwide. Ukrainian officials have warned that Russia's stockpiling cruise and ballistic missiles, presumably for another pre-winter aerial campaign against Ukraine's power grid. Ukrainian officials have in the past accused Russia of weaponizing winter. About half of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has been destroyed during the war with Russia. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
At least 13 people have died in eastern Uganda after landslides buried 40 homes in six villages. Uganda Red Cross Society said Thursday that the rescue effort is continuing. Local media reports said that authorities expect the death toll could rise to 30. The landslides happened after heavy rains in the mountainous district of Bulambuli. The Prime Minister's office issued a disaster alert on Wednesday, stating the heavy rains across the country had cut off major roads. This is VOA News. Mexico says the United States will be shooting itself in the foot if President-elect Donald Trump implements his threats to impose 25% tariffs on Mexican imports. The impact on business is huge. We more or less think that in the end, these taxes are going to affect the consumer in the United States, but also businesses, and around 400,000 jobs would be lost. The two spoke on Wednesday, just days after Trump threatened to impose the tariffs on Canada and Mexico as part of his effort to crack down on illegal immigration and drugs. Trump said Sheinbaum agreed to stop migration through Mexico. Sheinbaum indicated separately on social media that she told Trump that Mexico is already taking care of migrant caravans, calling it an excellent conversation. China released three Americans and imprisoned for years, and Beijing says the U.S. returned four people to China in exchange. AP correspondent Donna Water reports.
China says the four people the U.S. returned to China include three Chinese citizens it says had been held by the U.S. for political purposes. China says the fourth person had been sought by Beijing for crimes and had been living in the United States. The three Americans released by Beijing are Mark Swedan, who had been facing a death sentence on drug charges, and Kai Lee and John Leung, who were both accused of espionage. The Americans had been held for years. Donna Water, Washington.
Taiwan's presidential office said Thursday that President Lai Ching-te will stop over in Hawaii and the U.S. territory of Guam during a trip to the Pacific Island nations. The announcement sparked fury in Beijing, which insists Taiwan is part of its territory and opposes any international recognition of the island. Mao Ning, China's foreign ministry spokesperson. The Lai Ching-te administration's attempt to seek independence and provocation through political manipulation by visiting so-called diplomatic allies will not succeed, nor will it shake the firm pattern of the international community's adherence to the One China principle or stop the historical trend of China's eventual reunification. It will be Lai's first overseas trip since taking office in May. Taiwanese government officials have previously stopped over on U.S. soil during visits to the Pacific or Latin America, angering Chinese leaders in Beijing. Investigators say a doctor who was arrested in Berlin in August is now suspected of killing eight patients and in some cases trying to cover up the evidence by setting fires. The doctor, who was part of a nursing service's palliative care team, was suspected at the time of his arrest of killing four elderly patients in June and July and then attempting to set fires at their apartments. Police and prosecutors said Thursday that additional cases surfaced when they examined patients' files and carried out forensic examinations of suspected victims, two of whom were exhumed. That wraps up this update, but the world of news never stops. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight, on The Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here's what's coming up.
So what the ECN did is that they told the people in the country that they will be able to vote indefinitely until they announce that the voting has stopped.
That was reporter Vitalio Angula on the decision to extend voting in Namibia's election after problems occurred yesterday at polling stations. Details coming up. Also, the United States and European nations looked to Tunisia on security issues. And it's Thanksgiving here in the United States, a time for families and feasts. All this and more coming up on Africa News tonight. In Namibia, voting extended into today after many voters were unable to cast their votes yesterday. Several polling stations on Wednesday ran out of ballot papers, and some had technical problems, including machines that overheated, leaving many voters unable to participate in the election. A short time ago, I spoke with reporter Vitalio Angula in Windhoek, Namibia, for an update on yesterday's election.
The voting was supposed to end yesterday at 9 o'clock in the evening. What happened is some polling stations did not have ballot papers, and there were queues, and there was malfunction of electronic equipment. So what the ECN did is that they told the people in the country that they will be able to vote indefinitely until they announce that the voting has stopped. However, it seems that some of the polling did not receive that message because they turned people away. Others are welcoming people. But today, even now, there is some voting taking place. But I also just wanted to remind you that the voting was supposed to close and it was supposed to be one day. But the people on the ground are blaming the ECN because we had 1.4 million people registered to vote. And the voter turnout was good, but the problem is on their side, they didn't prepare for so many. So I don't know whether they had the assumption that people will not come out.
There was an issue or problems with the tablets used to check voters' identities using fingerprints. Have that been resolved?
Yes. No, that is a continuous problem. I'm also one of the observers of the elections, and where I was observing, in 2 hours, the machine starts to overheat. When the machine overheats, it can no longer work. So either you switch it off and you let it cool down, or you call the IT technician. According to rumors, they only had 2 IT technicians in the whole of Windhoek, which is the capital city. After a while, I think what they did at the station where I voted and where I also observed is that they let the machine cool down, and then the machine started working again.
Do you think the ECN was overwhelmed because many people voted, or what do you think was the cause of the problem?
If they had planned properly, if you're using a machine, even if I'm using my cell phone, I know it has a chance of overheating. If I am going to a point, there are some points, because Namibia in an election becomes one constituency. So people went to constituencies where they assumed it would be empty, and there were only sufficient ballot papers at that point. There's a place in Windhoek, which is a higher class area called Alessenheim. What they did, because it's got a residency of 150 people, they only sent 150 ballots. But people from Windhoek, assuming that it would be empty, all went to Alessenheim. And then what happened is they ran out of ballot papers, and it's 20 kilometers out, so they had to drive out and get more ballot papers and bring them here and bring them to Alessenheim. So that is a problem. It's a logistical problem that they didn't plan for, and people are blaming it on the ECN, Electoral Commission of Namibia.
Some analysts are saying that given the high turnout, there may be a second round of voting.
Maybe by court order, they have extended voting for another day until it closes. But there's already a letter of demand from the ECN, from one of the leading parties, which is actually showing that they are coming second, the IPC, Independent Patriots for Change. And they want voting to continue indefinitely or for there to be a rerun. Knowing Namibia as a country and having covered elections before, I would say that it will probably go to the courts and the ECN would not unilaterally decide.
The 2025 edition of the annual U.S.-led African Lion military exercise will take place in Tunisia, marking the most extensive exercise hosted in the country. U.S. military officials and military leaders from several of African nations involved in the exercise held a planning conference in Morocco earlier this month. Although Tunisia's army is relatively small compared with those of other African countries, the nation has become a critical hub for international defense cooperation and military activities in recent years, supported primarily by the U.S. and some European nations. Edmund Gareb, professor of Middle East history at George Washington University, discussed the U.S. and European security interest in Tunisia with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi.
One of the important things about Tunisia is its geopolitical position. It is a country that has also faced a lot of tensions. And of course, we know what has Tunisia was a country where the Arab revolt, or if you want to call it that, or uprisings that we saw around, you know, the last decade emerged out of Tunisia. Tunisia has also been a country that had been friendly to the West. But at the same time, it has had its problem with some of the European countries where they feel that they have not been treated on an equal basis. And this is regardless of the nature of the regime that's in power in Tunisia. So I think the U.S. is beginning to pursue a different policy where they have focused on building blocks. Now they are finding that it may be in their best interest to pursue a different policy and establish close ties with countries such as Tunisia, which they consider to be important. And that's regardless of what they think of the type of the regime that exists there. So the geographic advantage is a very important fact. The proximity of Tunisia to Europe, to the Middle East, to Africa, and the easy access among the participating nations, especially between Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. The second thing is that there's the regional security. There's this, the U.S. has always, sometimes it's exaggerated, but this concern about terrorism. That is also has been one of the issues that the U.S. Had taken and I think influenced its policies. And that's why it needs Tunisia or believes that it considers it needs Tunisia to address some of the security issues that are facing the United States and some of its allies. There's concern also about Russia. Maybe there have been at least improvement in relations between Tunisia and Russia as well. And that's where the issue of maritime security, there's been at least some articles in the U.S. which has by some of the think tanks which have expressed concern. But there's been concern about the Russians maybe having a base in Tunisia. And so in many ways, I think these are some of the factors behind the U.S. interest and the U.S. providing military aid, security aid, as well as some economic aid as well.
Since Tunisia's political transition in 2011, the United States has invested $1 billion in security cooperation with Tunisia, including up to $160 million in 2023 alone. How would you compare that huge amount of security investment to the U.S. economic assistance to Tunisia?
I saw a figure. It says that Tunisia has received since 2011 something like $1.4 billion. Out of this, and this is an interesting point that you have raised, the question is how small, relatively speaking, the economic aid, cultural aid, areas of cooperation, whether it's in tourism, whether education, while it's significant and it's helpful, nevertheless, it's only a small part of this amount. So this is $335 million have been used for non-military, non-security purposes. And the U.S. Agency for International Development has worked with Tunisia in a number of areas of education, the area of helping promote Private sector employment, the idea also of helping Tunisia as a country that is also an agricultural country, a tourist country as well. And but I think clearly it shows that what we have seen actually is that the U.S. believes that that's part of the two areas have to come together, although the emphasis has been mostly on security and military base.
That was Professor Edmond Gharib at George University, Washington, here. He spoke with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. Former Liberian warlord Prince Johnson, a key player in the 1989-2003 back-to-back civil wars, died today, aged 72. Officials from his Movement for Democracy and Reconstruction Party and the Senate told the French news agency, AFP, that he passed away at Hope for Women Health Center. Johnson, who was seen sipping beer in a video as fighters loyal to him tortured then-President Samuel Doe to death in 1990, was an influential senator and the longest-serving. The death of Doe was an early bloody episode that would plunge Liberia into two civil wars, which killed some 250,000 people and ravaged the economy. Prince Johnson was a leading opponent of the creation of a tribunal that would try civil war-related crimes. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Douglas Mpuga, in Washington. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. At least 13 people have died in eastern Uganda after landslides buried 40 homes in 6 villages. The Uganda Red Cross Society said today that 13 bodies had been recovered and the rescue effort is continuing. Local news media reports said authorities expect the death toll to rise to about 30. The Associated Press reports that landslides happened after heavy rains in the mountainous district of Blamboli. The Prime Minister's office issued a disaster alert on Wednesday, stating that heavy rains across the country had cut off major roads. Thanksgiving is celebrated every fourth Thursday of November in the United States, and many families include the entire family in preparing the food for the Thanksgiving dinner. Traditional foods include turkey, stuffing, gravy, sweet potatoes, cornbread, mashed potatoes, and cranberry sauce. Many people serve pie for dessert at the end of the meal. But for Africans living in the U.S., how do they celebrate Thanksgiving, which is different from the holidays they have back home? Maria Mellon is a native of Cameroon, and my colleague David Vandy asked her how long she has been celebrating Thanksgiving.
I have been celebrating Thanksgiving for the past 10 years that I migrated to the United States, and it's been a joyful thing leaving Africa to the United States and seeing something like Thanksgiving where family comes together. You know, I had to just go with the culture, and it's very, very amazing to see how people celebrate life, especially when it comes to the end of the year, you know, just to thank God for everything. So
yeah, you're coming from Africa, from Cameroon, right?
Yes.
So what kind of food do you prepare for Thanksgiving for the family?
Yes, for in Africa, from Cameroon, we have our traditional meal dishes that we prepare. We have fufu and kati kati. Fufu is like corn flour that you mix in the water and then you cook. And then kati kati is actually chicken, but you have to bake the chicken and cut it into pieces, fry it in the tomatoes, and also we prepare it. It comes along with spinach. You can make spinach, like fried spinach, and you prepare it together, eat with the fufu, kati kati. And we also have like achu. Achu is another meal.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so it's kind of like a yellow soup.
Oh, wow.
How I can really
I am already feeling it, the yellow soup in my mouth.
Yes.
But you know, in America the favorite part of Thanksgiving is the turkey. So do you also prepare turkey with, plus the traditional food that you prepare from what you used to eat back home?
Yes. Surprisingly, when I got here and I saw that on Thanksgiving everyone is buying turkey, so I had to just go with the flow, and I saw that it's something really, really good. I actually usually buy my turkey the day before. I make sure I marinate it, everything, for the next day. Yes.
For this Thanksgiving in particular, like today, are you expecting a lot of other family members to join you, or is just your immediate family?
Yeah, I'm actually going to join my the immediate family, and everything is being planned. Turkey,
wow.
Ready, and we're going to be meeting up for dinner. And other family are actually coming out of state. Since I live in Virginia, we're all going to meet together with the kids, with our own kids. And so we're going to come together to celebrate this day.
And before I let you go, Maria, what kind of holiday do you have in Cameroon that you would say looks like the Thanksgiving that you are now celebrating here in the United States?
Actually, we celebrate Christmas a lot. Christmas period, it's when a lot of people, family, actually come together and celebrate life. Even though it's the Christians celebrate as the day where Jesus was born, so we actually take it together and celebrate together with life, you know, and thanking God for all the blessing He has been doing in our life. So that's one of the main celebration in Cameroon.
And the kids love it?
Oh my God, they love it. They have been talking about Thanksgiving, like if it doesn't happen, it's not gonna be fun. So the kids, they actually love it. And most of our kids, they are born here, so they have been growing with the culture, so they actually know. And in school, they talk to them about Thanksgiving, so they've been talking about it. Okay, turkey.
That was Maria Mellon from Cameroon sharing her Thanksgiving experience with my colleague David Vandy. As you just heard, Americans nationwide are celebrating Thanksgiving today, a time when people give thanks for what they have. The national holiday was not proclaimed until 1863 by President Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. My colleague Carol Van Dam spoke with Hope Harrison, a professor of U.S. history at George Washington University, for more of the history of this holiday, which dates back to 1621, when the Pilgrims arrived in the New World.
The Pilgrims wanted more freedom and, in fact, independence than they could have in England. They didn't like being under the crown, the King of England, and sought to explore new lands and set up colonies, hence they were called the colonists or the Pilgrims, in the New World, which is what became known as the U.S., So they set out on a daring voyage, a long trip over the high seas, and ended up on the East Coast in what would become Massachusetts, near a place that is called Plymouth Rock.
And this happened in September 1620. They were on a really small ship. And then when they got there, like, it was pretty horrible for the people. A lot of them were already suffering on that ship, right?
So coming over on this small ship called the Mayflower, they were in obviously very close quarters. Some people got sick. Back then, we knew nothing about medicine compared to what we know now. So some of them had diseases which they died of, or they landed with these diseases, such as smallpox, and spread them to the Native Americans.
And speaking of the Native Americans, it was a couple of the Native Americans approached them and tried to help them, right? They had these outbreaks of contagious diseases, but despite that, they received help from the Native Americans, right?
Well, the Native Americans initially sought to help these sick people and obviously were also a bit nervous. You know, who were these people? These were their lands. They looked different. They acted differently. They spoke differently. This was the beginning of this interaction between the colonists coming over from England and the people who had long been settled on the lands.
It's a tradition where we Americans, we get together and we have this big feast. We make turkey and all these side dishes like cranberry sauce and potatoes and all different kinds of vegetables. And it's a celebration of that time that you're describing. But some people, especially Native American people, say that the true history, like the bloodshed and the oppression that followed that first initial meetings between a couple of Native Americans and these pilgrims, is covered up in a lot of the teaching of the U.S. history in our schools to children. Do you agree with that?
Yes, that is absolutely the case. You know, all nations have what they call founding myths. You know, moments that they look back, even though they weren't alive at the time, but they look back metaphorically, the founding of their country. And of course, they want to be proud of that. So things get pushed aside and whitewashed and, in fact, often erased that don't go with a comfortable, happy, proud narrative about the founding of the country. And so what is, in fact, the biggest celebration of a holiday, more than Christmas, because Thanksgiving gets people of any religion. It's not a religious holiday. You know, you celebrate kids in schools. They dress up as the pilgrims. Some dress up as Indians. You have pageants, and you celebrate what was supposedly this peaceful coming together in 1621. The pilgrims were celebrating a good harvest, and the Wampanoag Native Americans came to join them, and they signed a mutual defense pact.
That was Hope Harrison, a U.S. history professor at George Washington University. She was speaking with VOA's Cara Van Dam in Washington.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Vandy, and our engineer tonight, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.